Welcome back to lecture 5 of the standard model. Oops, I didn't change the beginning slide here. I always forget. That should just be the standard model. So again, this is a two-part lecture where we're going from the basic table, the most condensed presentation of the standard model, and then I'm giving all the ingredients where you can then carry out this little game of Lego or Sudoku or whatever you want to think of it as. To get the actual Lagrangian for the standard model of particle physics, derive it for yourself. And so then if if a couple of you are cryogenically frozen and the rest of humanity goes extinct, we can reconstruct human knowledge based on what you know when you wake up. You know, you have all these sort of ingredients. Okay, but first, there was a very good question at the end of the last lecture about why. Yes, thank you. Sorry. I'm actually answering your question right now about why the why is a mu valued in the Lie algebra X? Because there was this good point that it doesn't seem to logically follow from the exercise that we did showing how it has to transform under a gauge transformation, and that's essentially true. So why is it Lie algebra valued? Okay, so this is just a little sketch of why that is, and then I leave it as an exercise to think through this, and because this is quite a good point I should have mentioned. So first of all, remember that an element G of our gauge group can always be expressed as the exponential of a Lie algebra element, where little x is an element of our corresponding Lie algebra X. And if we consider an element G that's very close to the identity, so in other words, an element where e to the x is almost zero, we can approximate this as 1 plus x. Okay, so now how does our field transform? We know that under a gauge transformation, it transforms to psi goes to g psi. Well, not quite. It goes to the representation u of g times psi, the representation matrix u of g. And so every, if this is an n-dimensional representation that our matter field is transforming under, every element of g has been mapped to some n by n matrix. But then that means, every element of the Lie algebra X has correspondingly been mapped to some n by n matrix. So we can also write it as the exponential of not of x, but of the corresponding n by n representation u of x of psi, acting on psi. And then again, if we're talking about a transformation that's almost the identity transformation, infinitesimally close to the identity, then we can expand this exponential as 1 plus u. So this is approximately 1 plus u acting on psi. And so in other words, under a gauge transformation that's infinitesimally close to the identity, the change in psi, delta psi, psi new minus psi old, is just this part. It's just the matrix U of X. In other words, the corresponding representation, the n by n representation corresponding to the n dimensional matter field psi, corresponding representation of the Lie algebra element X acting on psi. Okay, good. So now think about. So this is a picture of a patch of the spacetime manifold, and here again we have a little point in our spacetime manifold. And remember that above that point we have our vector space V in which the matter fields live. And I've drawn not just one vector in that vector space, but I've drawn a basis for that vector space. For example, an orthonormal basis. That's sometimes called a frame. Forget about that. So now I want to think about parallel transport of a vector in this vector space. Or in particular, I've chosen, your n vectors that form a frame for the vector space, a basis for the vector space. I want to imagine parallel transporting all of those, parallel transporting the whole frame to some infinitesimally nearby point labeled by the coordinate x mu plus dx mu. Okay, and so what is the idea of parallel transport? So just like in GR, you've probably met parallel transport in your GR course, and it's very analogous. You know, what it means to take a vector psi in the vector space over the point x and parallel transport it to the neighboring vector space over the infinitesimally nearby point x mu plus dx mu, well, it means that if I differentiate psi along that path, if I take the difference between the psi here and the psi here, I say that they're parallel if the directional derivative along that direction, so the contraction of dx mu with the derivative is zero. Okay, but I don't take the directional derivative using the ordinary partial derivative. That wouldn't be a covariant statement to make. You use the covariant derivative. Okay, but so what is that saying? You know, so I've drawn a little picture of the idea here, that you know, as I use that rule to carry each of these vectors in the base in the frame above x mu, I parallel transport it this way to a new frame over here. So the new parallel transported frame is supposed to be the three solid vectors in this right figure. Now I can compare that to the frame I would have chosen over the dotted frame here is supposed to represent the frame whose partial would have been zero with respect to, you know, if the frame was really the partial here, if the frame was really the dotted frame here, and I took the difference between that dotted frame and this guy just using the partial derivative, I would get zero. That would be the one that would be parallel according to the naive derivative. And the idea is that, okay, in fact, the actual parallel transported frame will differ a little bit because of this extra term from that naively parallel frame. And the point is that I want to demand that the difference here between the naive and the actual, the amount of rotation I've had to do between the naive and the actual parallel transported frame is nothing but a gauge transformation, okay? And so the difference, the difference here between these two frames is represented by some expression like this, where we saw, so the difference between the two frames will therefore be represented by the by a term here, an extra that performs a little extra, there's this little extra close to the identity unitary or whatever the gauge group is rotation that I'm performing on this frame. And so the difference will be represented by an element of the Lie algebra, or the appropriate n by n representation of the Lie algebra element. And that's what this guy is. So this extra little bit here is exactly what this bit is about. So dx mu contracted with this guy will be this valued in the Lie algebra, or more correctly, in the representation of the Lie algebra element, the appropriate n by n representation to act on this guy. So that's the reason. And so I leave you to think more carefully about that to make sure that it's clear. But so that's why it's valued in the Lie algebra.
Just as we have partial derivatives on the space-time manifold, can we define a partial derivative with respect to the fields on the field space and have the notion of a covariant derivative where the partial derivative is with respect to, it's a functional derivative with respect to the field? field.
Mm-hmm.
Another connection which is different.
I don't know. I'd have to think about that. Have you thought about that? And you can do that. Well, I don't know. I think maybe we could discuss after. I'd have to think about that more to see if. And use that to define not the. You're thinking of just using that derivative in field space to possibly take derivatives of fields and define different terms than you might otherwise be able to define in the action. Maybe so. Maybe you could. I mean, it would involve introducing yet further fields that would represent the gauge fields, or in that sense.
Since we remove upper or lower index in the field space, it doesn't matter the upper or lower indexes in the field space, because that derivative is trivial.
Somehow physically the construction here is about trying to construct, you need to define covariant derivatives physically to describe, motion through the bundle, motion along the space-time manifold. And so physically it's about, you'll only have kinetic energy, you'll only have dynamics in your theory. Things kind of moving, waves propagating, etc., if there is some cost in the action to having things vary in space-time. And so the connection that we've constructed so far is about physically trying to write down terms with that property. A connection that allows you to write down covariant derivatives in field space would have some other physical interpretation. So we'd have to think about it. I'd have to do with something about a cost for things. I'm not 100% sure. I'm not sure 100% sure it makes sense, actually. I have to think about it afterwards. Interesting question. I'm not sure. Okay. Very good. Okay, so here just a brief to bring us back to where we were. This is the story about taking this table and turning it into this Lagrangian. And we had gotten to this point where, I put these two slides out of order. We had just seen, we had just gotten to the point where we had, seen that there was this, that the table, really was saying that there are these basic, equivalent way to write this table is that there are these, different ingredients. They're basically kind of different kinds of tensors from which we get to build the Lagrangian. They have all these different indices, and this table is, at least the first two columns in the table, are kind of telling you what indices they have. And then the final column is telling you about the charge that they transform with under a U1 transformation. Okay, so one more step that we want before we dive in and look at some terms is to, We briefly mentioned this, but I just wanted to go through it a little bit more carefully because I rushed through it at the end last time, is to say, how do the conjugate fields transform? So first of all, remember how things work in GR. In GR, if you have a contravariant vector, a vector with an upper index, its components transform under a coordinate transformation to new components v prime alpha, where the transformation matrix U, alpha beta, is the partial of the new coordinates dx prime alpha with respect to the old coordinates dx beta, acting on the original components. And so in other words, it's the matrix expression V goes to UV. A contravariant vector is a vector with a lower index, transforms in the, if you want, the opposite way. That its new components transform with, now it's the partial of the old coordinates with respect to the new coordinates. And in matrix notation, they are acting on this vector from the right. So it's like V with an upper index is a column vector, and it's being hit by the matrix U. from the left, V with a lower index is like a row vector, and it's being hit with the matrix U inverse from the right, because this partial matrix, as you hopefully thought about in GR course at some point, or will, or should check after the lecture if you haven't, is the inverse of this matrix. And so that's why, you know, that's why it makes sense to contract indices like this, because you have this, if you have two objects, by the way, I wrote V and V here, but it could be V with a lower index and W with an upper index. They don't have to be the same vector. So it would transform to V prime alpha, V prime upper alpha, but that just means that we get a U inverse in the middle here, and a U coming from the lower, coming from the contravariant vector and the from the covariant vector and the contravariant vector respectively, and U inverse times U multiplies to give just the identity matrix, of course, which would be more obvious if I wasn't writing all the indices out so explicitly. And so, in other words, we just get back our original expression, and great. So that's the thing you know and love from GR, that objects with all their scalars with all the indices contracted are scalars. So now in the Yang-Mills analog, okay, we have our, for example, this field Q left, which has all these indices. When I take its dagger, when I take Q left bar, well, first of all, I remind you that that's taking this column vector, complex numbers, and taking the dagger of it, so it becomes a row vector, and the components have all become conjugated. And then to make it transform properly under Lorentz transformations, as you have met in hopefully in a QFT course, you have to hit it by a gamma zero. Make this, that's how Q bar is defined. So now I'm going to just take, I'm going to write that as the same object, but, you know, well, I don't really do anything to the family index, because as far as we know, the family index sort of isn't doing anything. Nothing, it's not transforming anything. But all of the non-trivial indices that transform, I move them down when I take the bar or the dagger of a field. And so just to see, you know, just to make sure we understand why that is. So let's look at the SU3 transformation of Q left. So Q left has one SU3 index. So as far as SU3 goes, it's like a vector. It transforms like a vector. It transforms with one copy of the SU3 transformation matrix. So Q left prime goes to U3 Q left with all the indices included. That would look like this. You can check afterwards to make sure you know I'm talking about. So, okay, what would happen if we now took Q left bar? Well, you know, we just take the dagger of this whole transformation law, and so Q left bar goes to Q left bar prime, which is Q left bar times U3 dagger. We're just writing all the indices out again. Some expression like this. But, you know, U3 dagger, again, is, because U3 is a unitary matrix, U3 dagger is equal to U3 inverse by definition. That's the definition of unitarity. So once again, we have the analogous situation to what we had in GR. It makes sense to write this index down and this index up, because when we contract them and then transform, the object doesn't transform because, well, they get transformed. One, you know, the lower index contributes a U3 dagger, i.e. a U3 inverse, which hits the U3 that comes from the upper index transformation law on the right, and those guys annihilate to give the identity, and so the object Q left actually does Q left bar Q left just transforms to Q left bar Q left. And again, I emphasize that although I for some reason didn't think to do this, I wrote both terms here as, well, let me not emphasize that. And then finally, just to emphasize how it works for spinners. So Q left goes to some representation of the Lorentz transformation lambda, which I've just, because of, for notational simplicity, also called lambda here. But this is the spinner representation of the Lorentz transformation. And now Q left bar goes to Q left bar prime, which, because I've included the gamma zero here, transforms exactly like the inverse of that matrix, now acting on it from the right. And so that's an exercise which you may have done in a QFT course when you met spinners, is that, you know, Q left dagger on its own wouldn't transform with as lambda inverse it wouldn't transform with a matrix here, which was just the inverse of this guy. But that's why you include a gamma zero in the definition of Q left bar, because then it does transform like lambda inverse. So again, this object is invariant for the same reason as all the above objects.
The gauge indices are summed over, but there is no metric defined in the gauge space, except for the Killing form that you defined once. So this summation.
There is a metric in the gauge space, for example, for the unitary case, because it's the metric that defines the dot product between V and V dagger. It's just the trivial metric. That's in other words, there is this metric that is exactly what the unitary transformation is designed to preserve. A unitary transformation exactly preserves the identity. In the same sense that a Lorentz transformation preserves the Lorentz metric eta mu nu, in the sense that if you act on both sides with lambda and lambda transpose, you eta mu nu is invariant. In the same sense, delta ij, if you think about it, you know, delta ab, I should say, is invariant because the corresponding because in both cases the metric is what defines the inner product, and Lorentz transformations are exactly the transformations that preserve the inner product in Minkowski space, whereas correspondingly unitary transformations are exactly the transformations that preserve the inner product in n-dimensional complex space with a purely positive inner product, i.e. you take the dagger and contract it with this guy by multiplying the first element with its conjugate with a plus sign, and then the second element with its conjugate with a plus sign. And so there is this metric in the game also in the gauge.
So hypothetically, if the gauge group was if it had a pseudo signature, like SU2 comma 1 something, then then we would get Lorentz space-time kind of a metric in this summation.
Exactly. So when you were going to try to write down invariant terms in the action, you wouldn't want to just use the dagger of your original field. You'd want to use the dagger of the field multiplied by whatever pseudo metric, 2, 2 metric, or whatever is preserved by the if you were dealing with an SU2, 2 transformation instead of an SU4 transformation. So here are a few example terms. Let's just try to go through some examples to see why they work or why they don't work. So here's a first example. Suppose I took Q left bar from the ith generation and multiplied it by the Higgs doublet field, and then by D right from the jth generation. So if I wrote out all the indices here, that would be Q left bar with all this stuff below, and then H, it just has one index we saw on that earlier slide, and D, if you look at it at the table, it has, you know, yeah, if you just refer back to this previous slide, you'll see who has what indices. So this term, let's check if it's invariant. Well, if we look at all the Lorentz indices, this guy has a Lorentz index, and this guy has a Lorentz index, and they're contracted up with one another, and there's no other Lorentz indices left, so far it's Lorentz invariant. This guy has an SU3 index, little a. This guy has an upper SU3 index, little a. They're contracted up. There's no other SU3 indices running around, so it is SU3 invariant. This guy has a little lower alpha, and this guy has a upper alpha, and they're contracted up, so all the SU2 indices are contracted into nice pairs. There's none left over, so it's SU2 invariant. And now we just have to check whether it's U1 invariant. Well, under a U1 transformation, you know, Q bar, remember Q transformed with a plus 1/6 I phi. So Q bar will transform with a minus 1/6 I phi. H transforms with a plus 1/2, and D transforms with a minus 1/3. And if you add up these fractions, you'll see they're zero. So this one I've given a check mark. It's invariant under everything. Lorentz invariant, SU3, SU2, and U1 invariant. So that term is good. That term, you know, is in the standard model. What about this guy? So here I've taken Q left, contracted it with the covariant Dirac operator, and then with Q left again. So what about now? Well, Q left bar again has these. Okay. So the way I set it here was that you know, we went to a lot of trouble in designing the covariant derivative, so that it would have exactly the same gauge, so that the covariant derivative of a matter field would have exactly the same gauge indices as the original matter field did. Okay, so since Q left had gauge indices A and alpha, E slash Q left will have exactly those same gauge indices, and then D slash, remember, is an object with it's a matrix with one spinner index down and one spinner index up. And so at the end of the day, if you look back at the definition, again, it's been analogously designed so that D slash of Q has the same Lorentz indices as Q does. So D slash of Q has all the same indices, all the same gauge transformation properties as Q does. Is this guy Lorentz invariant? You know, yes, it is. This spinner index matches up. This SU3 index matches up. This alpha index matches up. So it's invariant under Lorentz transformations and SU3 and SU2 transformations. What about the U1 transformation? Well, Q bar, again, transforms with a minus 1/6 charge, picks up a phase of E to the, will contribute a phase E to the minus 1/6 I phi, but then that'll be multiplied by the phase coming from D slash Q, which is E to the plus 1/6 I phi. So those two phases will cancel each other. So it's invariant under everything. So again, it gets a check mark. Okay, good. So what about this guy? So here's Q bar times, so the left-handed quark bar times the Higgs doublet times the upright. Well, under Lorentz transformations, this A gets contracted with this A, and so it looks Lorentz invariant. That's good. Under SU3, this guy has a lower SU3 index, and this guy has an upper SU3 index, so it looks good in that sense too. This guy has an upper SU2, and this guy has a lower SU2 index. That looks good. It's invariant under Lorentz transformations, SU3 and SU2 transformations, but the problem comes when we look at its U1 transformation. So Q bar contributes a phase E to the minus 1/6 I phi, H contributes an E to the plus 1/2 I phi, U contributes an E to the plus 2/3 I phi, and so those phases don't cancel. So it's not U1 invariant, so this guy gets an X. This guy's no good. To fix it, let's instead take the same term but replace H with the field H twiddle we defined last time. I remind you that H twiddle is complex conjugate of H, but then multiplied by I sigma 2. And we do that because if you check how these two guys, how H twiddle and H transform under an SU2 transformation, they transform exactly the same under SU2, so that they can both be thought of as having the same SU2 index. Okay, so everything is the same. So in terms of the indices, in other words, everything's the same as before. So under Lorentz, SU3 and SU2, this term will again be invariant. But now if we check the U1 phases, well, we get the same phases as before from the first and last term. But now H twiddle, because it's really the complex conjugate of H, as the opposite, contributes the opposite, picks up the opposite U1 phase, E to the minus 1/2 I phi. So now these guys do cancel. So this term is invariant. And so this term, is in the standard model. Okay, so much for terms involving fermions. Let's just look at a couple examples involving gauge bosons. So here is the kinetic term for the SU3 gauge field. So we designed, we went through a long song and dance to make sure that this guy was both Lorentz invariant and gauge invariant, and so it's going to be good. It's worth thinking about, you know, what about this guy? What if I just took, instead of the gauge field strength g mu nu, which has two indices, what if I just took g mu, which has one index, just the gauge field itself, and contracted it with g mu? So that looks Lorentz invariant. I seem to be taking a trace and getting rid of, you know, getting rid of the gauge indices in that way. And yet, this guy gets an x. What's wrong with this guy? Good to make sure you think about that and understand why that is not okay. Or what about this one? Here I've taken the field strength for the SU3 gauge field and the field strength for the SU2 gauge field. I've contracted their Lorentz indices, so it looks Lorentz invariant. And then again, I've tried to take a trace to get rid of the gauge indices. But again, that term doesn't make sense. Good to think about why that is. Okay, and what about some terms just involving scalar fields? So here, for example, I've taken the Higgs field and taken its dagger, contracted with H. So that guy, this guy has a lower alpha index. This one has an upper alpha index, so it's SU2 invariant. It has no SU3 indices, so it's SU3 invariant. It's a scalar, so it's all automatically Lorentz invariant. And then in terms of U1 charges, this one contributes a minus a half, this one contributes a plus a half, so those cancel. So this guy's good. Similarly, you can check that this guy, where you take H dagger H all squared, that guy is also good. So those two terms will both appear in the standard model. Those will be the two terms in the potential for the Higgs field. But what's wrong with these, you know, if I tried to instead take a constant times the Higgs field itself, or a constant times the square of the Higgs field, or a constant times the cube of the Higgs field, or H to the fourth, et cetera, you know, all those are no good. So just make sure you understand why that is. And finally, what about some kinetic terms for the fermions? Why don't these ones work? So here I've taken Q left bar D slash times U right. You know, that has the, looks like the structure for a kind of, that guy is Lorentz invariant, but not gauge invariant. So it's good to, well, in fact, there's more wrong with it than that, actually. We'll get to that in a moment. Anyway, this one's no good. Make sure you understand why. Similarly, if I could try to contract, if I try to put down a kinetic term involving, you know, the left-handed quark and the right-handed electron, also no good. So just worth thinking through some exercises like that to make sure that you, will help you get the hang of what works and what doesn't. And then I think the, you know, point is that we're almost, okay. So one final key ingredient here before you can really play the game right. So far we've talked about how to make sure that the fields are invariant under Lorentz transformations and gauge transformations. But, you know, if those are the only two requirements you give, you'll find you can write down an infinite number of terms that work. So normally, when you define the standard model, there is an additional constraint that you impose, which is that you demand that it also be renormalizable. And when you now restrict to the renormalizable terms that are Lorentz invariant and gauge invariant, there's only a finite number of those. And so let's just see how that works. So this is all about the relationship between dimensional analysis and renormalizability. So here in this class, you know, we have and will be using dimensions where we've set speed of light and Planck's constant equal to one. So, you know, if speed, you know, the speed of light, that's length over time. So if that's equal to one, that's really saying that length and time are the same units. And then similarly, h bar, that has units of angular momentum. If you think about it, you're saying that's equal to one, and you already know that length and time are equal to each other, then that condition is really saying that time is also equal to the inverse of mass, same units as the inverse of mass. So we're going to be using units where length and time and inverse mass are all the same thing, really. Now, the quantum theory is defined by the path integral, which is some ginormous path integral over e to the I times the action over h bar. So the exponent, the argument of the exponential has to be a dimensionless number. And we've already set h bar to be dimensionless. So that's saying that the action had better be dimensionless in these units. Okay, so the action has to have units of m to the zero, or in other words, dimensionless. But then the action we know is the Lagrangian L that we're trying to construct integrated over spacetime, integrated over d4x. So this guy contributes units of length to the fourth, or in other words, mass to the minus four. So to make this integral dimensionless, L had better have units of m to the plus four. Okay, so every term in the Lagrangian has to have units of m to the plus four. Okay, now one more point, which is potentially confusing. So let's discuss it for a moment to get dimensional analysis correct. So there's two different conventions that people use for lengths in GR. So you know the line element ds squared is the product of the metric and contracted with dx mu and dx nu. Now ds squared, the invariant length element, well, that everyone agrees that has units of length squared. But there's two different ways to say, in this formula, where is that length squared coming from? It could either be coming from eta mu nu. Eta mu nu could be the thing with length squared. That's one convention. It could be that eta mu nu has length squared, whereas the coordinates, dx mu, the coordinate differentials are dimensionless. Okay, that's the kind of common convention that's used by people in GR who are dealing with Weyl transformations. It's convenient for various reasons. On the other hand, the other possibility is that the units of length are coming from the coordinates. It's the dx mu and dx nu each contribute a unit of length. So dx mu has units of length to the one, and the metric eta mu nu is just this dimensionless matrix minus 1, 1, 1, 1, 1. I said too many ones, but you know what I mean. And that's the particle physicist convention, and that's the convention that we'll take in this course for most of the time, at least. We may break and say something about Weyl transformations at the end, in which case we'll switch conventions. But for now, that's the story. Okay, so since dx mu has units of length to the one, ddx mu, has dx mu in the denominator, it has units of length to the minus one, or in other words, it has dimensions of mass. And so now we can begin to figure out what the dimensions of the different fields in the theory are. So let's look at the Klein-Gordon kinetic term for an ordinary scalar field, for example. It has we want the total dimension of this term to be dimension four, remember, because it's a term in the Lagrangian. We get two factors of mass from those two derivatives. So we need to get another two factors of mass now from the fields. We're working in these conventions where eta is dimensionless. That's telling us to get the right dimensions for this term, each scalar field has to contribute dimensions of mass to the one. So that's the dimensions of Klein-Gordon scalar fields. What about the Dirac Lagrangian? Well, we have this dimensionless gamma matrix times the derivative as units of mass to the one. So to get up to the right mass, dimension, we need three more. We have mass to the one here. We want to get up to mass to the four. We have two spinner fields to do it with. So each one has to contribute, mass to the three halves to get so that in total the term has dimensions mass to the fourth. So that's the dimensions of the spinner fields. And for Yang-Mills fields, well, the kinetic term here is trace of F squared. Remember, raising and lowering indices is irrelevant because that's all done in these conventions in a dimensionless metric. So we have F squared. So if the total thing has to have units of F to the fourth, mass to the fourth, then each F has to have units of mass squared. So F has to have units of mass squared. You get a factor of mass to the one here. So the other A has to contribute, the gauge field has to contribute units of mass to the 1 in these conventions. And then if we look at this final term, we see it also has to have units of mass squared. These two A's already contribute units of mass squared, so it's telling us that also in these conventions, the coupling constant G is dimensionless, which is something we already found in a different way earlier. Okay. And then finally, there's this, you know, point of all of this is that there is this theorem in quantum field theory that the terms that are renormalizable, your Lagrangian will be renormalizable if it only includes terms that have a non-negative, whose coefficient in front has a non-negative mass dimension. So, you know, every term in the Lagrangian can be split into a kind of operator built from the fields and a C number coefficient in front, which beta, which may have dimensions. And that, again, we want that total thing to have dimensions mass to the fourth. And again, the theorem is those terms are only allowed in a renormalizable Lagrangian if the coefficient in front, beta, the C number coefficient, has a non-negative mass dimension, or in other words, dimension, mass dimension, which is greater than or equal to zero. So the term, in other that means that the operator part has to have mass dimension that's less than 4. So for example, this term will be renormalizable because we have this first term, we have a mass dimension 3/2 plus 3/2 plus 1 is equal to 4. So that's good. That does have here the field, the operator has dimension less than or equal to 4. Here, the operator part has dimension 3/2 plus 3/2 is 3, which again is less than or equal to 4. So that one's good. Here, the mass dimension, the operator part has mass dimension 1 plus 1 is 2, which is less than 4. This one has mass dimension mass to the fourth, which is less than or equal to 4. This one has mass dimension m to the sixth, so that's no good. The coefficient then will have to have dimensions m to the minus 2 to get the total dimension right. So that's a non-renormalizable term. Similarly here, this is the famous Fermi term here that involves 4 fermions, 4 spinner fields. Each one contributes mass to the 3/2. So that has total operator part has mass dimension 6, mass to the sixth. So the coefficient has to have mass to the minus 2 to make it have right dimensions. And so that means it's non-renormalizable. Okay? Okay, good. So, yes?
Why do we require the renormalizability to define the Lagrangian?
Very good question. So, you know, once upon a time, people thought they were requiring renormalizability because, we'll discuss this more later, actually, but in brief, once upon a time, people thought that to make it be a consistent quantum field theory that it had to be renormalizable because then you could self-consistently renormalize things by just adding more terms of the same type as in the original theory, so it formed a kind of closed system. And then nature seemed to pat them on the back about that because even though that logic was maybe somewhat circular, it then you got a theory that seemed to match observations very well. The modern understanding of what's going on is different, that it still is the case that if you want to have a kind of complete quantum field theory, it should be renormalizable and have some finite number of parameters. However, it's thought likely to be the case that the reason that what we see at low energies is very well described by a renormalizable Lagrangian has a different origin. That in effective field theory, there's actually the whole infinite panoply of renormalizable and non-renormalizable operators, but that as you flow the energy to low energy and study the theory at low energy, the terms with negative mass dimensions get suppressed, their coefficients get suppressed by the renormalization group flow and become negligible at low energies. So that's the short answer, and we'll discuss that more. We'll be looking at both perspectives on the standard model later on, and talking about.
So in modern point of view, like lambda 1, 5, 6 terms is not forbidden.
They're not forbidden. No, they're perfectly allowed and consistent. It's just that you they're a signal that the theory is incomplete, and that at higher energies there's some bigger theory that it came from, and that if that bigger theory was renormalizable, but it had some fields that were too heavy for you to see at low energies, when you integrated out those fields, you would still get a theory at low energies that looked non-renormalizable when expressed just in terms of the light fields. That's the model. Okay, so one last thing. Let's get clear about some confusing points about spinners, just to make sure we're these are potential confusing stumbling blocks when carrying out the game. So, okay, first of all, these gamma mu's that we've been discussing, these Dirac matrices, I remind you that they are defined to be a set of matrices that satisfy this anti-commutation relation, so-called Clifford algebra, that the anti-commutator, so gamma mu, gamma nu, plus gamma nu, gamma mu, is equal to minus 2 times the Minkowski metric eta mu nu, where in my conventions, eta mu nu, I always take it to be, minus plus plus plus. Okay, so there's different you can express the gamma matrices in different bases, and different bases may be convenient for different purposes, but for discussing the standard model, it's very convenient to work in the so-called Weyl basis, where the Dirac matrices gamma mu look like, or the Clifford matrices gamma mu look like this. They're block off diagonal, so the 2x2 blocks. So this is a four-component 4x4 matrix, but this 2x2 block and this 2x2 block, the diagonal blocks are zero. The off diagonal blocks are given by sigma mu, sigma bar mu, where sigma mu is this four-component object where the first component is the 2x2 identity matrix, and the second, third, and fourth components are the I, J, and K, are the sigma 1, sigma 2, sigma 3, the three polysigma matrices. So this is like a four vector of 2x2 matrices. So for example, if I take the matrix gamma 0, this is sigma 0 appearing here, and that's the identity matrix. But if this was gamma 1, this would be sigma 1 appearing in this 2x2 block, and that's the first polysigma matrix. And then gamma bar is the same thing, except it has a minus in front of its polysigma matrices. Okay, now the Dirac spinner, I remind you, in four dimensions, that's the full four-component spinner. It's a column of four complex numbers. When I write chi left in this four-component notation, I mean I'm talking about a... So the Dirac spinner forms an irreducible representation of this algebra, unique irreducible representation of this algebra, but it does not transform irreducibly under a Lorentz transformation. Under Lorentz transformations, it breaks up into two irreducible components. The upper two components mix up between themselves. Those are called the left-handed spinners. That's called the left-handed part of chi. And the bottom two components just mix up amongst themselves, and that's the other irreducible component, the right-handed component of chi. So yeah. Oh. So a left-handed spinner chi L. That means a guy that has two complex numbers in its upper two components and zero in its lower two components, whereas chi right is the opposite. Complex numbers in the lower two components and zero in the upper components. Okay. So then there's the charge conjugate of a field. That's another thing. That's another ingredient we are going to need. So that's very analogous to the Higgs field. Remember, the Higgs field, we said that if we took its complex conjugate, that the complex conjugate no longer transforms under SU2 the way that field, the original field did, but if we multiply it by I sigma 2, then this new thing, H twiddle, does transform the same way under SU2. Well, there's a very analogous story with spinner fields, that if you take the complex, you take the complex conjugate of a Dirac spinner, it no longer transforms the same way under Lorentz transformations that chi did. But if you now multiply it by i gamma 2, you get this new object, the charge conjugate field, which does exactly transform exactly the same with the same, under a given Lorentz transformation, chi and chi c transform with exactly the same Lorentz transformation. So, but if you think about what happened here, because gamma 2 is off diagonal, if we started with a left-handed chi, which had two non-zero upper components, and now we take its charge conjugate, we get the new field has two non-zero lower components. So the charge conjugate of a left-handed spinner is actually a right-handed spinner, transforms like a right-handed spinner. And similarly, yeah, and vice versa. The charge conjugate of a right-handed spinner actually transforms like a left-handed spinner. Okay, one more thing is we've mentioned this before, but just to be clear, so you know, slash again always means in spinner notation, that means that we took something that had a one index, one spacetime index, and we contracted it with the spacetime index on gamma mu. So this thing is now a matrix with two spinner indices that are just not shown here. And similarly for same notation applies for a slash. This is now we've taken a gauge field which had one spacetime index, contracted it with gamma mu, so it no longer transforms under Lorentz transformations. It no longer has a hanging tensor spacetime index, but it does have two spinner indices. It's a matrix in spinner space. So with those ingredients, it's useful to think about the following facts. That if we look at if we try to make now kinetic terms analogous to the, you see, we're splitting up chi left and chi right as two separate fields because the standard model is a so-called chiral gauge theory, meaning that as you saw from the table before, the left-handed fields transform completely differently under the gauge transformations than the right-handed fields. For example, the left-handed fields transform non-trivially as a doublet under SU2, and the right-handed fields, for some reason, don't. Why is that? Nobody really knows why that is. That's some mysterious pattern, unexplained pattern of nature, but that's the way it is. So now we want to try to write down, you know, kinetic terms and mass terms. We want to write down all these terms, but built from these left and right chiral fields rather than a full four-component Dirac spinner. So consider the following, that if we take any spinner bar contracted with partial slash contracted with a spinner, that will always be a Lorentz invariant object. That's what Dirac figured out. But in the actual standard model Lagrangian, we will write down a term like this, and we will write down a term like this, where chi left bar is contracted with chi left, or chi right bar is contracted with chi right. But if we tried to write down a term where chi left bar was contracted with chi right in a kinetic term like this, well, it would be Lorentz invariant, but we don't write it down because it's also zero. And similarly, if we could try to write down a kinetic term which contracts chi right bar with chi left, that would be zero. So, you know, it's good to just check to make sure you understand the above few lines here, to make sure you understand why the last two kinetic terms are zero, whereas the first two are not. By the way, I should have mentioned again, I keep doing this in these notes, but so I wrote the same letter chi here and here, or here and here, but actually, I mean, if you take any left-handed spinner and contract it with any left-handed spinner, these could be two different spinners, chi and psi, for example. That would be Lorentz invariant and non-zero, whereas if you took any two-component spinner and any two-component spinner, which were left and right, and tried to contract them in a kinetic term, even if they were different guys, that would be Lorentz invariant but zero. So the zero has nothing to do with the fact that these are the same spin. And finally, for mass terms, it's the opposite, that now it's the case that if we contract a left-handed spinner bar with a right-handed spinner, or vice versa, that is Lorentz invariant and non-zero, so we could, in principle, try to write down terms like that. But if we try to contract a left-handed spinner bar with a left-handed spinner, or right bar with right, that's Lorentz invariant, but 0. And so again, just make sure you see why that is. Fine. So those are all the rules of the game. You're ready to play now. Yeah, basically I unleash you. I recommend this as like maybe one of the most valuable few things you could do as a grad student would be to really think through how the table translates into exactly these terms. It's really, you'll see you end up, yeah, to think carefully through about it, you'll end up learning a lot, I think. And this will be the Friday tutorial will be devoted to doing this. So just to say this, walk through this quickly in another slightly different way in the remaining couple of minutes. You know, here, let's first think about what kinetic terms we can write down, what terms we can write down involving derivatives of the fields. Well, there's the kinetic term for the three gauge fields. There's the kinetic term for the Higgs field, which is just the Yang-Mills generalization of the usual Klein-Gordon kinetic term, which we saw before. And there's a kinetic term for each of the different fermion fields in our table. And you notice that we only have written down kinetic terms here that connect Q left, you know, a field R with itself. Like, we don't have any terms that are like, so we have Q left with Q left, U right with U right, D right with D right, et cetera. There's no U right with D right or Q left with L left. No sort of mixed kinetic terms here. That's not by definition. That's a consequence of the rules of the game we've described. So you want to make sure you understand why that is. Okay, so those are all the kinetic terms for the spin 1, spin 0, and spin 1 half fields. And then the rest of the terms have no derivatives in them. So there's the ones that can be built just with the Higgs field themselves. Those are the so-called Higgs potential terms. And then, as we mentioned before, there are some that can be, there are four different terms that can be built with by combining two different fermions with a Higgs field. It's 1, 2, 3, 4 Yukawa terms. And then in those Yukawa terms, there is the coefficient matrices here. These have an I and J index, the family index. So if I let I and J run from 1, 2, 3, these are actually 3x3 matrices of constant complex numbers called the Yukawa couplings in the standard model. The 3x3 matrix that appears here in between Q left and U right, I call that that's YU, the uptype Yukawas. The 3x3 matrix that appears here between Q left and D is the downtype Yukawa matrix. The one between the left-handed lepton doublet and the right-handed neutrino is called the neutrino Yukawa coupling matrix. And the one between the electron and the left-handed lepton doublet is the electron type Yukawa matrix. And then we have this explicit guy. This is, you want to convince yourself that this is the only explicit mass term you can write down in the standard model. By an explicit mass term, I mean for fermions in the standard model, for spinner fields. If you want to make a term involving spinner fields that just involves two spinner fields, that's called an explicit mass term. It has a coefficient which has dimensions of mass. And you want to make sure you understand why it is impossible to write down any term like that involving any of the spinner fields in the standard model except for the right-handed neutrino. And then finally, as we discussed, there's this another oddball term is this GG dual term, where G is the gauge field strength we defined before from the Yang-Mills field strength, and G dual is the where we take that and we hit it by this epsilon tensor. In four dimensions, there's two invariant tensors, eta mu nu, the metric tensor, and epsilon mu nu alpha beta, the epsilon tensor. And I'll leave these two to describe next time because I've run out of time. So I'll leave that last thing. Okay, no, I can't resist it. Sorry. At least this one line I can't resist mentioning. I can and will. Never mind. Okay. That's it. Any questions?
Should I expect that Lagrangian be symmetry under exchange of R and L?
Under R and L? No, the standard model is not symmetric under exchange of R and L because it's a so-called chiral gauge theory. So a theory that does have that symmetry is called a non-chiral gauge theory. And again, it's an observed fact about the universe that it does not have. It could have had that property. It's kind of a mystery why it doesn't have that property. But no, it's not symmetric.
I think this R and L, as usual, are right and left, and you know, sensible.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So it's related to right and left in the sense that, fields that are right are fields that are right chiral. The easiest way to say it is that in the massless limit, fields that transform like a right chiral Lorentz transformation, like a right chiral spinner, if they are massless, they describe particles that have that spin in the same direction as their momentum. Their helicity is positive, and antiparticles that spin in the opposite direction to their momentum. Whereas left chiral fields are the opposite. They look like the mirror image situation where they describe particles that have left-handed helicity, i.e. spin opposite their momentum, and antiparticles that have positive helicity. In other words, the laws of nature that we see are not invariant under if I showed one experimenter, a bunch of actual videos of experiments, and asked them to infer the laws of nature. And then I showed another experimenter all the same experiments, but secretly reflected in a mirror, but didn't tell them that it was reflected in a mirror, and asked them to infer the laws of nature. Those two experimenters would infer two different Lagrangians for the laws of nature that are not equivalent. So that's the standard model is parity violated. As we'll see, it's really the SU2 times U1, the weak part, that's parity violating. The SU3 part, the strong force, and the in gravity are not parity violating. They look the same. If those were the only forces of nature, it would be invariant. But because of the electroweak part of the Lagrangian, for some reason, it's maximally parity violating, sort of complete as different as it can be between left and right.
Why do we need the Yukawa matrix?
In what sense do you mean?
Because the Lagrangian would be a scalar and would not transform. Would be a scalar and a Lorentz transformation, gauge transformation.
Oh yeah, good question. Well, I leave you to think about this more. But the point is that's a very good point. But I'll just rephrase it a different way. So. The term Q left from the first generation bar contracted with U right from the third generation, let's say, that's perfect. And then with H twiddle in between, that's perfectly invariant on its own. And I just get to put a coefficient in front of it. But then when I take Q left bar from the first generation and U right bar from the second generation, that term also is invariant on its own. So I just get to put another coefficient in front of that term, but nothing a priori, nothing about the symmetry requires me to put the same coefficient in front of those two terms. So I can write down 9 different terms like that are all separately invariant. So each of them can get a separate invariant coefficient. And this nine component matrix is nothing but collecting those 9 different a priori independent coupling constants. So it's not that it's needed there to somehow transform. It doesn't transform under anything. It's just a matrix of constants. It's not that it's needed there to kind of make those terms invariant. It's just that there are secretly 9 different terms you can write down because there's 3 different options from the 3 different family options for the first fermion and 3 different family options for the second fermion. Each of those terms is separately invariant, and so there's no a priori reason that they should all have the same coefficient or anything like that. So instead, they have an arbitrary matrix. In fact, the same thing would be true of the kinetic terms for the fermions. You would naively, at first glance, write down 3x3 matrices there, too. But in that case, I'm still deciding whether to. I'm not 100% sure this is. I'll include this in this year's course because I'm trying to make time for other stuff. But you could include those 3x3 matrices in each of these terms here too. That would be perfectly compatible with Lorentz invariance and gauge invariance. But then, without loss of generality, you can redefine the fields by using 3x3 unitary matrices that connect the mix. You can, without loss of generality, redefine the rotate the fields in generation space to remove those matrices. So in this line, in the kinetic term, you can do that. But then you've used up most of your freedom to redefine the fields. So you cannot rotate away the matrices in the Yukawa line anymore. So that's sort of the conventional way to write the standard model. The first line is diagonal in this way, but the Yukawa line is not.
Are these matrices part of any
field? Not as far as we know. I mean, it's just a mysterious pattern about the standard model that that everything is copied three times. So there is this threeness running around, but so far there's no evidence that there's any symmetry of the standard model Lagrangian under that kind of rotates the generations between each other, and there doesn't seem to be any. I mean, the fact that these Yukawa matrices are just weird matrices seems to break such any known symmetry of that form. And it also doesn't seem like there's, you know, all the other indices seem to be an indication that there's a gauge field that couples to transformations of those indices. There's no evidence that there's anything like that for the generations here. So, yeah, it's just an unexplained extra bit of structure so far. I think it's related to triality, but that's a separate story. Anyway, okay, yeah, if there's no more questions, see you tomorrow.